Operation Hope is having a free food giveaway for all federal furloughed employees and their families, those affected by the federal government shutdown. This will be happening on Thursday, 10 o'clock in the morning at the Northeast Regional Command Center, 9600 Dyer. It's also through the auspices of District 4, Representative Carl Robinson. So, Mr. Robinson and Operation Hope teaming up together to feed federal furloughed employees. All you need to do in order to pick up food for you and your family is just bring your federal ID to the Northeast Regional Command Center, 9600 Dyer, and you'll be good to go. If you need information on that, all you need to do is hit us up on our website at ktep.org. This morning, we welcome back Rabbi Levi Greenberg to the radio station. Welcome. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning. We talk about charity. We talk about Operation Hope and District 4 helping out furloughed federal employees. But charity stretches all the way across the board, all the way across every demographic, sociographic thing that you could ever think of in your lifetime. And what we do, I think, needs to be practiced every day. Somehow, I think sometimes we forget.
That's true. I mean, charity is not just something that many people need, but it's something that everyone is obligated to give, and everyone can give. That's the concept of charity. That's not just that everyone is on the receiving end in one way or another, but everyone, really everyone, can be on the giving end.
Mm-hmm. It starts at home. Parents should be teaching their children how to give charity, how to receive in order to give, and then settle back and see how the seeds of charity actually spread into goodness and joy.
Don't just settle back. Keep on planting more seeds.
Right. There you go. Yeah. And see, that's my fault is that I stop at a point and I shouldn't. I should always give every day.
Yeah, it's actually a fascinating concept how when it comes to charity, when it comes to giving, there is no limit. I think it's important that we are talking about this today. Tomorrow is going to be 69 years of the leadership of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the leader of the Chabad Lubavitch movement. You mentioned earlier today the concept of immigrants bringing certain foods from other countries here to America. The Rebbe was an immigrant. He was a very fascinating type of immigrant. The Chabad Lubavitch movement began in Russia over 200 years ago. And the Rebbe's father-in-law, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, he was the leader of the Chabad movement in Russia. He became the leader in 1920. And that was when the communists started, you know, the Soviet Russia was under communist rule and they were starting to shut down organized religion. And the Jewish religion was a target. And the Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, realized immediately that in order to keep Judaism alive in Russia, it would need to be underground and it would demand much sacrifice. And he encouraged his students to fearlessly go to every place where a Jewish school was shut down and to start Jewish classes and to teach the children. And this came with a lot of risk, a lot of personal risk. And in fact, the Rebbe himself was arrested in 1927. They wanted to send him to the firing squad, but miraculously his life was spared, and he was sent out of the country. From there he went to Latvia and then Poland, and in 1939, when the Nazis invaded Poland, he escaped to the United States. And so the Chabad Lubavitch movement transplanted itself in the United States. His son-in-law followed him as well, and in 1950, when the previous Rebbe passed away, in January of 1950, his son-in-law took over the leadership of the Chabad Lubavitch movement, which was 69 years ago tomorrow. And whereas his father-in-law brought a fearless sacrifice to the Jews living in Soviet Russia, the Rebbe brought a fearless pride of Judaism to the Jews living in the United States. And his leadership is a fascinating one. Mm-hmm. He took a very small group of Hasidim and he turned them into a worldwide influence. Today, Chabad is in every corner of the globe, in over 100 countries on every continent. And the Rebbe's message essentially was, we have to be proud of our heritage, proud of the truth, and share it. That's the idea. You can't keep it to yourself. You have to share it with your fellow Jews, and you have to share the truth to the entire world.
There's something that I read last night before dropping off to sleep on Chabad.org. And it had to do with something.
It's a good website.
Yes. It's a wonderful website. I've been signed up to that for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, trying to learn more about Judaism, trying to learn more about Chabad. And one of the teachings last night was about, if I can try, I'm trying to pull that up on the website, and the computer's kind of slow, because there's something that's really important about that with our conversation right now. It's something about not being able to consume whatever it is that you're offered in a temple, in a synagogue. You're not allowed to eat it. It's part of a, I'm trying to find, I'm understanding it, but I'm not understanding it. It's something that you would offer someone else, but you're not allowed to consume it yourself.
Right. In Israel, agriculture was the main way people made a living. I mean, you have to plant in order to make food. So, during the Holy Temple era, there was one tribe that was not apportioned a plot in the land of Israel, and they were the Levites, the Levite tribe, and there was a part of that tribe were also the priests, the Kohanim, and they would serve in the Holy Temple. And so, the Jewish people were obligated to give certain portions to them in order to support them. Okay. Some of these portions were considered sacrificial, or they were sanctified. And so there were certain limitations of who was allowed to eat them and in what circumstances they were allowed to be eaten. So what about that teaching caught your attention?
What caught my attention was the very thought of not being able to consume something, even though it's sort of being offered.
Perhaps you can say that the fact of the matter is that when we think about holiness or divinity, mm-hmm. we talk about something that we think intuitively, we think about something that's abstract, not something that's practical.
Okay.
And this obligation of giving a tithe or giving a certain portions to a certain demographic because they served in the Holy Temple, that's basically taking the food that I have, food that I can eat, food that I planted, and it's really mine, and I'm able to separate that and make that divine. And I think the lesson of that is that in order to become divine, one does not need to be spiritual or abstract. You could take the very practical day-to-day parts of life and turn them into something godly. Take, for example, the concept of charity. Charity is money.
Right.
And money is really a paradox. You could do great things with money, you could do terrible things with money. You know, it's all, or money could just sit in the bank and rot, you know, and go nowhere.
Yeah.
And so really when we take money that is our own and we give it to others, we share it, we take that money and we turn it into a divine money. We turn it into something that's truly otherworldly. And it can really make an impact on our world. What's interesting is that the Rebbe, throughout his leadership, initiated several campaigns to encourage fellow Jews to do mitzvot, which are commandments in the Torah. And one of them was a tzedakah campaign. Tzedakah is the Hebrew word for charity.
Okay.
And the concept of this campaign was not a major fundraiser to bring in millions of dollars in order to support Chabad institutions. This campaign was to educate every single person in the world about the concept of charity. Maimonides was a great Jewish sage who lived in the 12th century, and he said the following, he proposed the following question. What is better, to give a large sum of money at once or to give smaller amounts many times? It's an interesting question.
Right.
The truth is, in order to make a large impact, in order to really make a big change on the spot, you have to give a very large sum. You know, that's how things really move. However, when someone gives money, he gives charity, and he gives it all at once, so that's a beautiful thing, it's a great endeavor. However, when someone gives small portions of money every single day, it's like a muscle. You become a charitable person, you become a giving person. So the Rebbe's charity campaign was that every person should have a box, a container on their desk, in their bedroom, in their kitchen, whatever it is, and every single day give some coins into that box. You can call it a charity box. You can call it a giving box. And when that box fills up, take out the coins, count up the money, take the sum and send it off to a worthy organization and give it to someone who's homeless, someone who can need it, who can use it. And like this, even though you could have sat down and written out a $50 check at once and sent it to an organization, but like this, when you give charity every single day, and that accumulates to $25, $30, $42, and then you give that charity, then you give that money to the poor or to a worthy organization, at that point, it's the accumulation of many, many days of charity that is coming to a head. And okay, that really transforms a person. So essentially, the Rebbe was teaching us that charity is not about the amount that you give. It's really about how many times you give it. And there is a value in giving small amounts on a consistent basis.
I see that. Yeah, I just pulled this up from this morning, the Daily Mitzvah from Maimonides,
that's right. Yes.
And it's about Deuteronomy 12:17, you may not eat within your gates the tithe of your grain. So does this just apply for consuming outside of Jerusalem the grain set aside for the second tithe?
Yeah, this was a specific instruction that is relevant to the tithes that were separated in the land of Israel. It does not apply in the diaspora. So specifically in the land of Israel, there was a certain type of tithe they needed to separate and bring that value to Jerusalem and provide food for those that were living in Jerusalem at the time.
Okay. They'd
have to eat it in Jerusalem.
Can that actually be applied anywhere in the world, or does it be specifically for Jerusalem?
The obligation is specifically in Israel and in Jerusalem.
Uh-huh.
That's the obligation of the mitzvah, of the commandment. You know, if you want to take this idea and apply it in other places, no one is going to stop you. But specifically, in other words, the interpretation of the verse in Deuteronomy applies. I mean, it says it very clearly.
Yeah,
that's in the land of Israel.
Okay, I'm applying this to where we live and what we do, and it actually starts to begin to make a whole lot of sense about charity. I know charity in the context that we've been discussing is about money, but it seems like lately, maybe over the last, and I want to take this into the 20th century, where charity began to take a whole form all of its own from the Great Depression all the way through the world wars and to where we are now. Charity is not only just about money, but it's about sharing food items.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when it comes, the concept of charity is not necessarily that you give actual legal tender to another person, even though that is essentially what charity is all about. But if you can give food to a person, that's an even greater type of charity. Charity comes in many different formats, but not necessarily is it possible to give food to another person every single day. We live in a society where, there is relative wealth. You know, even those that are on the bottom of the barrel, it's not like they're going around and asking for food, at least not in the most part. So your typical guy wakes up in the morning, doesn't necessarily interact with people that are specifically asking for a sandwich. And therefore, the way to give charity today, if you're not able to give a sandwich to someone, is to set aside money that will accumulate to the point where you're able to buy someone a sandwich or give it to an organization that will reach out to these people.
Right.
So charity takes many different formats. It's not limited to legal tender necessarily. Talking about the Rebbe and his charity campaign, the Rebbe practiced this himself. There were many people that wanted to have a meeting with the Rebbe. You know, starting in 1950, when he became the leader of the Chabad movement, he was recognized as a mentor and teacher to many millions. And people would take the opportunity to have a meeting with him. Three times a week, he was available for private meetings. And over the years, the lines grew. And to have an appointment with the Rebbe, sometimes people would have to wait weeks and months. And in 1980, 30 years into his leadership, it became impossible for the Rebbe to continue this concept of meeting people privately. And what's fascinating is that in 1986, on his 84th birthday, in the spring of 1986, The Rebbe started a custom of standing outside of his office, and anyone was able to come and speak with him or greet him very briefly, and he would give every person that came by a dollar. And he would tell them, take this dollar and give it to charity. That was the concept. I'm making you a messenger to give charity to another. And it was rooted in a teaching by his father-in-law. Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson said, when two people meet, a third should benefit. So the Rebbe was saying, you're coming to me, you're asking for a blessing, for advice, whatever it may be. Take this dollar and pass it on. Give it over to charity. And obviously, you know, a dollar coming from such a holy person, such a sage, people would keep that dollar, mm-hmm. and they would, you know, instead of giving that dollar to charity, they would give $10 to charity, or more money to charity. They would keep that dollar, and this would be like a memento of their meeting with the Rebbe. But the message was, on a constant basis, this was every single Sunday from 1986 until 1992 when he suffered a stroke. The Rebbe stood for hours, and thousands of people came by with all different, from all walks of life, with all different issues and you know, different things that they wanted to bring to the Rebbe's attention, or some people would just come and receive the blessing. And the message to each one of them was exactly the same. Take this dollar and be my messenger to give charity.
Okay. We live in a society where we're, for the most part, very suspicious of others. And that's sad, because until you walk in the shoes or even just the footsteps of that person, you don't know from day one what that person has been through. And so I know several people, and I'm very guilty of this as well, where the suspicion of people prevents me sometimes from giving, although I know better. And at the end of the day, I always feel like I have to apologize for my callousness. Is this something that we need to work through on a personal basis, or is there a way where we can actually fix this?
The truth is that you know, you're not the only one that suffers from it, and I think this is something that's pretty much across the board. No one wants to feel like a sucker, that they gave money to the wrong person. You know, money that I worked for and that's mine, and to give it to someone that doesn't deserve it, so to speak. So I don't know if there's a way that we can fix this across the board, you know, make a big campaign that people shouldn't be suspicious of others. But I think everyone on a personal level is able to, you know, if you think about the money that you have, you know, it's an interesting concept that the Hebrew word for charity is tzedakah. Now, tzedakah really does not mean charity. Tzedakah, the word tzedakah in Hebrew really means righteousness, doing the right thing. Charity connotes the idea that there's money that's rightfully mine, and I'm so nice, I'm going to share it with someone else. Tzedakah means, no, the money is not rightfully yours. God is giving you that money. You're like his banker. So he gives you that money, and he expects that a certain portion of that money should be shared with others, those that have less. There is a famous teaching in the Talmud that King David complained to God. He said, why did you not share the wealth equally? Why is there the rich and the poor? It's not fair. And God responds to King David and says, if everyone would have everything that they need and have it equally, who will do tzedakah? Who will do charity? Who will share? If everyone had what they needed, if everything was equal, so we wouldn't need each other. There would be no reason to share with each other. There would be no reason for a community. And so in Judaism, we believe that God set up the world in a way that there are the, you know, those that have more and those that have less. But essentially, we receive everything from God. We come to this world with nothing and we leave with nothing. And so while we're here, God gives us money. And obviously, you have to work in order to make that money. God says very clearly in the Torah, in the Bible, I will bless you with the work of your hands. You know, we have to make a vehicle and a vessel for that blessing. So we need to go to work and, you know, work more. And essentially, everyone understands that whatever you make is a blessing from God. And so when we view our money in that way, at this point, When I look at my money, it's not, am I going to give this money to someone who's not deserving? It's, this money really does not belong to me. It should be shared with others. Now, if you know for a fact that the one who's asking for that money is a fraud, I perfectly understand why you would not want to give it to that person. But sometimes we do not know. And we have to give people the benefit of the doubt. And essentially, the fact that a person could be in a situation where he is asking for handouts, he's asking for someone to give him, that itself places him in a situation where perhaps he is deserving for that money. So again, I'm not here to decide who is deserving and who is not, and I don't know if we can fix this problem across the board, but it's just a meditation that every person could have on their own that would give a new perspective on this concept of charity. It's not about me being benevolent, it's about me doing the right thing.
Brings me to this whole notion of Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol. Ebenezer Scrooge, obviously, through the three spirits of Christmas, wound up learning exactly what you're talking about in terms of charity. But from a different perspective, it was a complex character with a complex set of problems, which, according to Dickens, happened because of a skew in a relationship. Dickens wrote of Scrooge being one who didn't understand charity, didn't understand that love is a charitable thing that you have to give in order to receive. And the third and most important part of the whole thing is to be understanding of others' plights. And so A Christmas Carol is that kind of a thing. I don't want to call it a paradox, but it certainly does make a whole lot of sense from a gentle sort of persuasion kind of a thing. It makes sense. But it also brings to mind the notion that's been passed around. I remember my parents saying this, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. So when we make money, but we don't share it charitably, the Lord can easily say, you know what, you keep working, but I'm going to take it away from you. And now you have to understand exactly what I was trying to tell you about why you're working so that you can give to others who really need a hand.
And the truth is we can focus on the positive part. You know, no one becomes poor from giving charity. No one loses out. When you give, you're really receiving. There's this anecdote about a person that he made a lot of money, and he tells the burial society that they should bury all the money with him. And you know, when he goes to the next world, and he comes up there, and he's dragging these sacks of money, and the angel asks him, "What's this?" He says, "Well, this is all the money that I worked for throughout my lifetime." So they said, "That's not legal tender here." He said, "So what is?" "Receipts." Charity receipts, that's the legal tender in heaven. But, you know, I'd like to share an interesting story about charity. Allegedly, this happened with the founder of the Chabad movement, Rabbi Shneur Zalman. There was at one point that there was a fellow Jew who was in debtor's prison. And in those 200 years ago in Russia, being in debtor's prison wasn't fun at all. I mean, his life was in danger. So the rabbi was going around and trying to fundraise the money to pay off the debt. And so he comes to a town, and the local rabbi and the president of the community, they sit down with this venerable sage, the great rabbi, you know, the leader of the Chabad movement, and they write up a list of all the people in the community and how much money they're going to ask them to give to this cause. And so they're walking down the street, and they're going, you know, house to house, and people were able to give whatever they could. And at one point, they walk past a mansion, and the rabbi looks at the mansion and he noticed that it was a Jewish home. So he said, "Why don't we walk in here? Perhaps he would also like to give to the cause." They said, "Rabbi, don't waste your time. He is the miser of town." So the rabbi said, "No such thing. No such thing. Everyone wants to give. I'm going to go and ask him." So they come to the front door and he knocks on they ring the bell and the butler comes and says, "How can I help you?" He says, "I would like to speak to the owner of the house." And so this very wealthy man comes to the door. He says, "Rabbi, what do I have the honor of your visit?" And so he starts to describe to him the plight of this Jew who was in debtor's prison. And the man is listening, and he says, "Rabbi, this is such a terrible story. I would like to help out." And he pulls out of his pocket a green kopeck, like a penny, but it was already green. You know, it was already rotted. So he gives it to the rabbi. Now, the local rabbi and president of the community, they were enraged. How could this man, you know, shame the Rebbe in such a way to give him just a penny after hearing such a story? But the Rebbe takes the penny with a big smile and he says, "Thank you so much for your donation. May you be blessed." And he just, you know, very effusive in his thanks. And he turns around and he walks away, you know, going on to the next house. And As they walk down the road, the man calls them back. He says, "Rabbi, come back here." Comes back to the home. He says, "You know, I was thinking about this this story. I want to give you some more." And he gives him about 50 ruble. Now, the local leaders were shocked. They had never seen this man give so much money. Okay? And the rabbi, the reaction to the 50 ruble was identical to the green kopeck. And he walks away. And then after a few minutes, the wealthy man calls them back. He says, "Rabbi, how much money do you need? What's the full amount?" And he tells him whatever it was. He goes into one of the rooms. He brings out the full amount and he gives it to the rabbi. He says, "Rabbi, I want this to be my mitzvah. I want this to be my good deed of charity." So at that point, the local rabbi was beside himself. He says, "I don't understand. There were many rabbis that have been here to fundraise for many important causes, and you gave them nothing. So what's the deal?" He says, "Let me tell you something. Many years ago, it was early in the morning, and I was walking on the street, and a pauper walked up to me, and he asked me for something, you know, for... So I had nothing on me besides for a penny, for a kopeck in those days. And he said, well, I felt bad giving him something so little, but I couldn't give him nothing, so I pulled out of my pocket. I pulled the kopeck out of my pocket, and I gave it to him. And the man took the kopeck, and he threw it back at me, and he spit in my face, and he said, 'Aren't you ashamed to give such a small and insignificant amount?' And he walked away. He said, 'I was so insulted by that response, by that reaction, that I vowed I would never give another penny to charity until someone would accept this kopeck from me with a smile. And Rabbi, you are the first one that accepted it from me with a smile.' And that's what changed everything." Now, when you analyze the story, there are some very interesting points here. Number one, first of all, I do not justify this man's reaction to the insult. You know,
yeah.
The poor man was upset with the penny. You know, move on and continue giving charity. You don't have to deny yourself the joys of giving and sharing just because someone insulted you once. However, stuff happens and people react in their way.
Right.
And this man reacted in that way and no one knew about it. Now, how did the Rebbe understand this concept? He invoked two important truths. Number one, everyone wants to do the right thing. Everyone wants to give. What's stopping them from giving, I don't know. But everyone wants to give, and therefore we have to give them a chance to give. So that's number one. That's what brought the Rebbe to this man's doorstep. But then when the man gave the Rebbe a kopeck, the Rebbe wasn't bluffing when he thanked him for the kopeck. He was invoking another truth, that when it comes to giving, the quality of giving is no different if it's one kopeck or $1 million. It's the same concept of giving. And therefore, when a person gives one penny, he's a giver. Obviously, we need to have the philanthropists that give large sums of money. A lot has to be done. But even that little bit is valuable. And, you know, I hear from many people that they say, you know, when they come home at the end of the day, they have change in their pocket. And they just take that money and they put it into the charity box. And after a while, you never know how much money that's going to accumulate and make a big difference. And I realize that the English language is fascinating. You take the word change. Change can mean make a difference, or change can also mean the small little pennies and coins that you have in your pocket.
Right.
And the truth is, to make a change, all you need is to take those small coins that are in your pocket, those little, that little valuable money that you may have. And if you channel it in the right direction, you can really make a real change.
Wow. That's an incredibly powerful story, so on so many different levels. And it's something that, quite frankly, as we live in tenuous times, makes a difference. It makes a big difference. Because it's not, as you say, it's not the amount, but it's the motion of giving, the emotion that's behind it. It's the desire to give. And like you said, and I've seen this downtown at the bus terminal more often than not. People may not have change for the bus or anything, but they may have one of those paper transfers. Here's a 50-cent transfer. Maybe this will get you on the bus.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that charitable gift in of itself is something that's really special. If you don't, As a listener, as you listen to this whole thing, if you don't believe me, just go to the bus station. You'll see it every day. You'll see it at least once every 5 minutes, especially at the downtown terminal. It's whenever I need to really put a grip on reality, that's where I go. I go downtown and I watch it, because that's life. That's life teeming with hope. you know, rather than despair. You know, people, I guess there must be some kind of a biblical saying or something in the Torah or someplace that says never wear your emotions on your sleeve. You're not supposed to. God says not. You know, you're supposed to be able to go through the day and bear the weight of the world, but don't tip your hand to it. That's something that is yours, and you need to work your way through it. But on the other side of that coin, people don't need to know what you're going through unless it's to a point where you really need help.
Right. There is a value to sharing what's on your mind with others. But I think it's important not to use that emotion or that dejection as an excuse not to act.
Right.
Right. So when it comes to action, for example, when it comes to giving charity, you don't have to feel in a certain way in order to do so. If you make it a habit that every morning when you wake up, you start off the day with giving charity, and you educate your children to do so, and you encourage everyone that you know to do so as well, it makes no difference what you're going through. No matter the circumstances, everyone has what to give, and everyone is obligated to give in their way. And this is actually very pertinent to the concept of education. When you want to educate children, instead of preaching to them that they should be givers, why don't you train them to be givers? And when you give every child their own special giving box, and everyone has their little piggy bank, they're having, you know, to save their own money, but perhaps give them a different type of piggy bank, a different type of box, which is their giving box. So when they come home and they have a few coins in their pocket, they can put some in their savings, but then some in their givings.
Mm-hmm.
And like this, you train children to be givers. In fact, you train people to wake up in the morning, and instead of saying to themselves, what will I make today? The question is, what will I give today? What type of opportunities will I capitalize on to turn my own personal value, monetary value, into something that's really valuable by sharing it to others, sharing it with others?
I have a long past friend now who is a giver. We would be out on news stories, and it didn't matter where we were. If he saw someone in distress, if he saw someone in need, he would actually stop the news unit, go through trails of traffic, lanes at a stoplight, just to make it to that person, hand that person whatever he had in his pocket, and then jump back into the news van and off we'd go. And it always touched me, because I should have followed with him to help him, and I didn't. And so the lessons that I kept learning from him are the lessons I'm learning from you as reinforcement to, you should have done that. So why didn't you? And that's what brings me back to the question of, how do we break the cycle of mistrust in order to be able to break through that ceiling and lend a hand?
I mean, the truth is that mistrust is really ingrained in society, and that's one of the roles that charitable organizations play. You know, when there's an organization, if you're not comfortable giving money to someone that you see on the street, instead you give the money to an organization that's going to translate that money into food that will actually help that person. So even helping someone find the right address to the organization that will help him or her, that itself could be a form of charity. So the truth is that when it comes to the small cash, there is a value in giving it, no matter, you know, who it is. But if a person wants to give large amounts to charity and they're anxious of giving it to undeserving people, so find an organization that you trust that is able to do so in the best possible way.
Okay. Let me ask you a question further on down the line. Purim is coming around the corner.
Oh, boy. You're 2 months ahead.
I don't fully understand the scope of Purim.
Purim is a story that happened over 2,000 years ago in ancient Persia, and it was during the first exile from Israel. And the story is clearly it's there in the Book of Esther. The story, in a nutshell, is that the Ahasuerus, who was the Persian king at the time, he controlled all of the lands, all of civilization. To make a long story short, somehow a Jewish girl became the queen I'm not going to go into all the details right now. Perhaps closer on to Purim, I can come back on the show and we can
Please
go into
do.
More details. But at one point, there was a man named Haman who wanted to get rid of the Jewish people. He convinced the king to make this terrible decree of annihilation. And Esther, who was the queen, together with her cousin Mordechai, who was the leader of the Jewish people, they were successful in neutralizing that plot, and everything turned on its head, and Haman was killed, and the Jewish people survived. And it's really a story of divine providence, of God running the show behind the scenes.
Okay.
So that's the holiday of Purim. So I think we can focus on that in a different conversation. But I'd like to also point out something that you mentioned earlier about the friend of yours that we would notice something, who would go out there and try to help.
Mm-hmm.
It brings to mind an interesting story. There's a man named he was the chief rabbi of Britain, and when he was a student, his name was Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. So when he was a student in Oxford, he was about 20 years old. He decided to go to the United States, and he wanted to meet with all the different Jewish leaders and to interview them to see what they say about the continuity of Judaism and if Judaism could survive in the New World, especially as a result of assimilation. And he had the opportunity to meet with the Rebbe. And he comes in, a young man, bright, and he asks the Rebbe many different questions. And when he was finished his interview, so to speak, the Rebbe said, "You asked me questions, I would like to ask you some questions." He said, "Sure." This was the first time that one of the leaders wanted to ask a question from this 20-year-old student. So the Rebbe asked him, "What are you doing for the Jewish community at Oxford?" Now, Jonathan Sacks at the time, he was no rabbi. In fact, he had not had a yeshiva education. He had not had a higher Jewish education at that point. And he was just a student at Oxford. And so he starts saying, "Well, Rebbe, in the circumstances that I'm in," he's basically trying to give an excuse of why he's not very much involved in organized Jewish life on campus. And the Rebbe stops him and says, "You don't find yourself in a situation. You place yourself in a situation." And the Rebbe changed his life with that line, with that message. What the Rebbe was saying was, "You think you're 20 and insignificant? That's not true. If you find yourself in Oxford, that means you can make a difference to your fellow Jews and to your fellow students at Oxford." So you're not placed in a situation, you place yourself in the situation. And that's really what changed his life. And he became from one of the most influential Jews in the world today. And it all came from this concept that the Rebbe was not trying to develop a following. He was educating anyone that would listen that they themselves should be leaders as well. And this all ties into this message of charity. Every single one of us can be a leader. Every one of us can contribute to society in one way or another. And if you're just awake and alert to all the opportunities that present themselves, use them. And you can truly be a leader. A leader doesn't mean that you command an army or that you have millions of dollars. Every person, by virtue of the fact that they woke up that morning, is living proof that God needs us on this earth to make a difference and to be leaders in our special way.
I think you've just pretty much solidified questions that I've had in my mind about positioning in life. I don't find myself in situations. I chose to do whatever situation I'm in. And now it's at a point where I have to find a way to figure it out. But despite all of that, the bottom line is, the three things I take away from our conversation this morning. Number one, charity is nonpartisan. It runs all across the board, and it doesn't matter who it is to whomever it is. Charity starts with me, starts with you, starts with whomever. The second thing is that charity doesn't necessarily have to mean money, but it certainly is all about giving to another person, to lend a hand up. And third and most importantly is, without charity, humanity wouldn't be humanity.
we wouldn't be a community.
Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be an all-inclusive community. Everyone gets to play nicely in the sandbox, as I say. But that the nonpartisanship really rings out. I know I have neighbors who are furloughed and are trying to figure out how they're going to make their payments. I have got relatives who are furloughed in San Diego, and they're trying to figure out how they're going to make this, that, and the other, how they're going to be able to eat by Friday. Yeah, I understand that. I wish I could help them, but I know I can help in this community by giving to someone who can then help someone else. That's how it works.
Exactly. Don't try to reach the end of the earth. Start here, and that will have a ripple effect.
That's intriguing. Oh, my gosh. As they say, you know, things happen for a reason.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, think of it from this standpoint. We were supposed to have this conversation last Tuesday, and things got in the way of a good time, but not necessarily so. Seems like the direction came at the right time.
That's right.
You know, we talked about Operation Hope and the food giveaway for Thursday for furloughed employees at the Northeast Regional Command Center. That's just one form of how many different organizations in town are trying to help. And it's not just the furloughed employees. There are the refugees in town who keep coming looking for a better life. They need a hand as well. There are the people who already live in El Paso. They're part of our community, and they need help. And it doesn't matter what strata. They all need help. And charity starts with you.
Exactly. I could not have said it better.
Wow. What a lesson. What a set of lessons. I really do appreciate everything. Rabbi, thank you so much for coming in. And again, you know, Mikasa Sukasa. By the way, I have a song queued up that we could play here at this moment. Shall we talk a little bit about this, Rabbi?
Well, yes. The Rebbe in the 50s and the early 60s taught different religious songs to the Hasidim, to his followers. Some of them were slow and reflective, and some of them were very joyous. Most of the songs are connected to the holiday liturgy. And this song that we're going to play now, it's actually a combination of two songs that were taught in the early 60s by the Rebbe. They're in Hebrew, so there's no translation. But the tune themselves are very upbeat and inspiring. And right after that, there's another song that was very much beloved by his father. Also a very exciting and upbeat type of song. So I hope you all enjoy it.
All right.
Genuine Hasidic music.
Here we go on 88.5 FM KTEP.
At
KTEP 88.5 FM. It's 10:55, and our guest this morning is Rabbi Levi Greenberg. Rabbi, wonderful music, great messages, great things to think about for not only today, but for life in general.
Thank you, Dennis, for the opportunity to share these messages and for the wonderful conversation.
oftentimes we find ourselves questioning things that seem to be on a surreal level, and I'm not sure exactly why that is. Maybe it's the abstract idea you spoke of earlier. Maybe it's the potential of having something more intangible so that we can call it something special rather than for it to be a reality.
That makes sense. That makes sense. But I think the Torah, the Bible, is all about forcing us or encouraging us to take the tangible and make that special, make that meaningful. So if someone is wondering, how can I make a real change in the world? Is it by, is it by meditating? No, it's about taking a coin and sharing it with another. You've already made a change. Take the simple, the mundane, the tangible, and use that out in a way that, it, to a certain extent, could be counterintuitive. You know, the coin is mine. I should keep it. No, go against that that model and take that coin and instead share it with another. And with this, you're taking your plain life mm-hmm. and making it meaningful on a daily basis.
That friend of mine that I told you about earlier, who passed away just recently, actually, one of the things that bothered him was, long story very short, he had bought a lunch for this one gentleman. And the gentleman, rather than to accept it modestly, threw it on the ground and said, "Nope, that's not what I want. I want money." And it irritated him. And I told him that he shouldn't worry about it from that standpoint. I mean, you offered, and he took it, so that's acceptance, but decided not to accept it in a form that you would expect. You know, the reality of it is that after we left, in the rearview mirror, I saw that the man picked it up and wound up chowing down on it. Okay, so okay. There's a sense of pride that comes into play with something like this. And somehow currency has a tendency to kind of wash that away just a little bit.
Yes, that is true. I mean, Maimonides points out that there are many different levels in charity. The highest level being, you know, giving someone a job or a loan. So that may, you know, their pride is absolutely intact. But then he continues, you know, making different levels. You know, sometimes you give money and you don't know who is receiving it and the receiver doesn't know who gave it. That would be like, you know, going through an organization that everything is anonymous. Sometimes you can give money to a person and the person doesn't know who gave it to him, but you know that you gave it to this person. Mm-hmm. And there are many different levels. And the lowest level actually is giving money to a person with a sour face. Like, you know, I really don't want to give you, but I'll give you anyway. So that's charity. It's the lowest form of charity because you're making that person feel bad at the fact that he's receiving money from you.
Right.
So essentially, when it comes to charity, there are many different ways it could be given, many different levels, and you should try to aspire to do it in the best possible way. And sometimes there's a virtue in specifically giving the money anonymously, and that the people should be able to receive it anonymously, and therefore their pride is intact. It doesn't work for everybody. You know, so we have to make sure that there's enough charity out there for all formats.
Food for thought, literally. Yeah. It's a way to feed the soul and pay it forward. You know, we oftentimes nowadays hear it, especially from the millennials, about paying it forward. And whatever they do in order to make that happen, that's what makes them happy. But that's also part of the charitable thing that they learned at home. And they may not have learned it at home, but from their peers. I'm finding that out more and more and more. So if anyone has a question about what we've discussed and a whole lot more, how do they get in touch with you?
You can email me at Rabbi Levi, that's RABBILEVI, at ChabadElPaso.com, ChabadElPaso.com. That's my email address, and I'll be happy to answer any type of question, to engage in any type of conversation, and I hope to be back again sometime soon.
As we get closer to Purim, we'll do that, definitely. Rabbi, have a wonderful day. Mikasa Sukasa.
Thank you, Dennis.
Coming up is an NPR News update. On the other side of that, we'll go ahead and launch a long set of mainstream jazz. You're listening to 88.5 FM KTEP El Paso, your NPR station for the Southwest.